About an hour ago, people gathered in the East Bottoms for an announcement from J. Rieger & Company. The local distillery's been staking out territory in the East Bottoms for an ambitious new complex that they're calling Electric Park. That was the name of an amusement park, beer garden, and picnic area from the late 19th century. It was run by the Heim brothers, who had a giant brewery in a building nearby, and it was quite a scene until Prohibition shut it down. The Heim brewery building sat abandoned for the most part for about a century. Well, earlier this year, J. Rieger & Company started talking about bringing the whole thing back to life. They want to put in office space, retail space, and a giant distillery. And today, they announced that they have actually bought the 60,000 square foot Heim Brewing bottling plant. They plan to open it in the spring. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about how something like this might change the East Bottoms, but also how the neighborhood's already been changing. Michael Bushnell is here with us from the Northeast News. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good, how are you?
Doing great, thanks.
How about this news, huh?
This is great news. For the East Bottoms community at large, it's fantastic news.
We'll get back to the news, but I'm curious about what you are seeing in the East Bottoms right now in general, because this kind of interest in a site like this doesn't come from nowhere.
It really doesn't. I'm down in the East Bottoms quite a bit because it's an easy way to get from, say, for example, City Market over to where our offices are near Belmont and St. John without all of the traffic and stoplights. So I keep track of not only the residential part of the East Bottoms, which is where this is located, that's where the brewery was located, but also some of the more industrial areas that are a little bit farther east on Front Street and Gardner, excuse me. I'm just... But I think it's great news, and it's been a long time coming, and I've seen the East Bottoms kind of morph within the last 10 years to become, it's got a funky vibe now. And with Local Pig being down there, and Urban Provisions was right next door. But then when the brewery properties started being acquired and redeveloped, and you start to see the old buildings, the faces of the buildings themselves change and they get upgrades, like the fire station that was right across the street from the brewery building, Heim number 20, I think it is, and it still stands. And to see that get the facelift that it so desperately needed is really kind of exciting.
So for people who aren't familiar with some of the places you're talking about, when you talk about Local Pig and Urban Provisions, you know, a butcher shop and with a sandwich area outside, and then Urban Provisions they've moved to, right?
They're moved down to the crossroads, yeah. I believe.
But that was like a little kind of maker product, kind of handmade stuff, assortment of handmade stuff.
Exactly.
But these are storefront scale developments. And when we're talking about something like Electric Park, that is much bigger than a single storefront.
Oh, my goodness. Electric Park took up all of that green space that's just to the north of Knucklehead Saloon. They're in what's known as the Chestnut Greenway. And all the way up to Nicholson, that's essentially where Electric Park was. There by the old Town Topic Hamburgers with the big parking lot and all the truck trailers there now. But it's really kind of exciting to hear the Rieger news this morning because of what that means as far as the draw that will be the East Bottoms again. It's actually going to be a destination for craft distillers and hopefully more maker fairs that have been taking place there once or twice a year. And I attended an event last November that I think you were there too,
yeah,
for the old Electric Park, and that was Atlas Obscura, I think.
Yeah, then an out-of-town presenter. And we're going to talk about that more. But I'm curious, let's just back up. What do you think people should know about the history of the East Bottoms? Because you are a real history buff. You have this collection of local postcards that are kind of famous. And you know a lot about this area.
It really was the earliest part of Kansas City proper. Francois Choteau's first fur trading post was right across the river to the north. And when that got washed away in a flood in the early 1800s, he relocated essentially to the foot of Troost Avenue and First Street and Troost And the development really kind of went down the river bottoms first. It developed as Belgian potato farmers, and there were Croatians down there, and all different manner of Europeans occupied that area. And sadly, we lost one of the oldest Catholic parishes in the city here about a month ago when St. Seraph's burned on North Montgall. And the first church service took place in 1877 in a log cabin on Rochester Avenue, and that was the beginning of that parish. And for a long time, it had a school. And there are still people that live in Northeast that went to that school and remember being confirmed in that school. And there's a number of houses, smaller working class, almost cottages in the area that were built in the early 1920s, 1930s. And the population has gone in the last 10 to 15 years from about 190, 200 households. Now we're down to about 140. And some of them are changing hands, but some of them still are in the same families that have lived there for 50, 60, 70 years.
How would you describe the community of residents there? Because as an outsider, when I come to the neighborhood, I get this feeling that there is a real tight-knit community, and I'm definitely on the outside of it, and I kind of want in because there's something very charming. This is maybe not fair, but it feels a little like the land that time forgot, and it feels like a portal into some other era.
It most definitely is the land that time forgot, and it is a very tightly knit community. And a lot of times when those houses, you know, people age out of the house and they've got to be placed in a professional care facility, that house might remain in the family, but maybe the right of first refusal goes to the neighbors or to a friend of the neighbors. And you don't see a lot of for sale signs going up down in the East Bottoms. You just don't. And a lot of times those houses will change hands very, very quietly, legally, but very, very quietly. And nobody knows they've even hit the market. And that's the case with some of the houses that are just to the north of Knuckleheads behind the Old Town Topic on the west side of the street. All of those have changed hands within the last 10 years, and not one of them hit the open real estate market.
What's that about? It's that's just there's that kind of love for that place?
It's just, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's kind of the land that time forgot. It's very tightly knit. There is a strong sense of community. A lot of the old timers, they really stick by each other. And, you know, hey, you're messing with my neighbor. Get away from, you know, you need to be aware. And so, I mean, there's that kind of neighborhood community feel. It's still a very tightly knit community.
Well, Michael Bushnell, hang out with me. I want to bring in another guest now. She goes by the name Jacqueline Danger. And my craziest experience thus far in the Heim building happened because of Jacqueline. She puts on big events in abandoned spaces and asked me to participate in this very elaborate extravaganza, I would call it, in the Heim building. The space was lit with torches, and people had to sign waivers on their way in. Jacqueline, good morning.
How are you doing, Gina?
Good. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
So what made you want to bring people from all over the city? Because you really did promote this actively. You got partners from very mainstream cultural institutions on board with you. You brought people to experience this old Heim Brewery building last fall when it was just this very bare-bones space without lighting fixtures or anything.
Well, a lot of it was Atlas Obscura was going around the country and doing their big new book release tour. And the year prior, they had not been able to stop into Kansas City. And so when we got the chance to be able to bring them back this year, 2017, we thought that the best tribute to them would be able to take one of the most historic and awesome pieces of history in Kansas City and bring it back to life. And so that's when I had gotten in with the East Bottoms and had the wonderful gift of being able to meet Pam Nigro of the Nigro Family Partnership, which she is now the owner of the actual Heim Brewery facility compared to Andy Rieger that then owns the bottling facility. And so we talked to her and told her what Atlas Obscura was and the book release and just decided to be able to like, hey, let's make this into this awesome event that's be able to celebrate the community of the East Bottoms and the rich history that it has and bring it to life in one night.
Are you excited about what's happening now?
I am excited to hear what J. Rieger's being able to do with that building, it's wonderful. Like, I, you know, they've had the distillery side going for quite a while, and I know him and John McDonald have been having that, had that building, and that space, which I know has been used for some events or weddings, it's been sort of sitting idly. And there was some talk at some point that it would be this kind of European farmers market, and it sounded like a really interesting take on, like, just to have all this new hustle and bustle and access to food. But that didn't really take off, and so it's really exciting to see that building now in use. And so I'm very pro anything that's historic architecture, whatever it takes to actually preserve that and keep it, rather than, like, you know, St. Francis Serif, like, burning in a fire. Like, I'd much rather see it be saved and reused.
Do you, how do you feel about the change in the neighborhood?
Well, it's interesting. It's a lot like the reflection of the West Bottoms, where, you know, these buildings, you're at least seeing them being saved and now reused. But you kind of see how the tides are changing in that area. Like, it's awesome to see, like, there's more interactions and more reasons for people to come down there and play, not just knuckleheads, but, you know, now being a hold of Local Pig and now the Rieger and the future of Pam's whole area of the Higham Brewery. But you do also see, like, the kind of, you know, the shadow of what's probably going to happen to the folks that live down there and their houses. The lucky thing, though, is, like, if they aren't going up for sale, they're not going to leave anytime soon.
What is your, tell me about just the time you've spent down there and what it's been like for you. I mean, when I went to this event and was getting ready for it, you just very clearly really knew your way around and had been on the ground there for quite a bit.
Well, the East Bottoms, like, when the first time I remember, I've lived in Kansas City now for 11 years, so the first time I'd visited down there, it's a real, like, Wild West feel to it. Like, and, you know, and nowadays it feels like, yeah, it's a little bit more safer and built up. Like, maybe there's a bit more police presence. You know, it's a little safer. But, you know, I went down there to go visit the chief, who's this, like, really incredible outsider folk artist that I'd describe him, which he's now passed. And you could just stop by his yard, and he has all these amazing welded sculptures everywhere. And there's people invite you in and talk to you. And so it just is sort of like this, almost like this really colorful, big character neighborhood that kind of sounds like a little, like, nerving, but, like, we do what we want. And so I remember when we were all sitting on the porch talking to the chief as he's giving us a tour around his wonderful sculpture, we hear this giant explosion in the distance, and it's like, oh my gosh, what is that? And it's like, ah, don't worry, that's just like our neighbor Randy. He's cops told him to stop doing that, but he's keeps shooting the propane tanks with shotguns to entertain his kids. And it's like, wow, you can do anything in the East Bottoms. This place is amazing. Like, and so it's a lot of kind of weirdo experiences like that. It's kind of, you know, it's a community that a lot of people from the rest of the areas of the city don't often go to sit and drink or eat in.
The I'm surprised that no one has mentioned a train, not once.
Oh, there's lots of trains down there.
That may be what, like, people from the outside, that's like the sort of the signal that you are in the East Bottoms is if you are waiting for a train to pass on the way to your destination.
It is, and if there's probably six or eight active, very active railroad crossings in that little bitty section of the East Bottom. So if you don't know your way around, you're just going to sit there and wait for that train. Well, you know, you can back up and just go up to the Gwinnett ramp and then go back down the hill, and there you're on the other side of the tracks. But
so it's only outsiders who get stuck.
Yeah, but it's neat for me from the standpoint of living up on top of the hill, and you get to hear all of the sounds of the rail yard, all of the train horns, the brakes, the cars, you know, smashing together in the couplers and things like that. And it's just, it's a sound that I don't think a lot of people know, but we've really gotten used to it, and it sounds like home. It's very, very nice.
So, but there are distinctive sounds and distinctive smells in the East Bottoms. And when we talk about how the neighborhood is changing, you know, being, if you're an outsider stuck in traffic due to trains, hearing the sound of trains, no matter what else is going on, and in addition, being surrounded by certain smells, like, does that limit what could happen in this neighborhood, in your view?
I don't think so. I'm used to listening to General Mills and the beeping and the constant hum of the machinery, the train noises. And if the wind is just right from the northwest, you can smell spees and the vinegar and things like that. So people, that might be a turnoff to some people, but I guess I'm one of the oldsters in the room. So that to me, that just smells like home.
It is interesting, you know. I had worked with the KCDC West Bottoms Revival Project, and as they're mapping the bottoms, they have these markers that they say like bad smell areas, and how that's very undesirable for people moving into the West Bottoms, either to live or to work. And so I do think that like one of the things in the East Bottoms that has that maybe will slow down like any amount of gentrification or progress of growth is like you do get these strong like stewed vegetables smells maybe coming from the cargo plant or the vinegar from the spears. And there's also a big smell of, you know, you get some sewer from the water treatment plant down there, but also General Mills has all that nice smells of cereal coming out of it.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be continuing this conversation about the East Bottoms in just a minute. Call 816-235-2888 with your questions or your perspective if you spent time down there or know the neighborhood in a way that a lot of people might not. 816-235-2888. When we return, the owner of Local Pig weighs in as he prepares to leave the East Bottoms. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about the East Bottoms. We've heard from Jacqueline Danger, an event producer with a group called the Cannonball Roarers, and Michael Bushnell with the Northeast News. Now I want to talk to Alex Pope, the owner of Local Pig and Pigwitch. He's in the East Bottoms, but not for long. Hi, Alex.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Why are you moving?
Well, Pigwitch got a little bigger than we ever planned, and
That's the same which part of the operation?
Which is a food trailer. And, you know, after 5 years, I decided we didn't want to do food truck life forever. And we needed a brick and mortar restaurant. You know, we looked for more than a year at retrofitting the building. Unfortunately, that was going to cost a lot more than the building was worth. And we just really couldn't pull off the retrofit to make it an actual indoor full-service restaurant. So we kind of started looking around and, you know, I wanted to stay as close as I could. And we landed in the historic city market in the River Market District. So we're really excited about that. But, of course, you know, East Bottoms has been home for a long time. So it's not without, you know, some heartstrings being pulled that we are moving on. It's been, you know, like they said, it's a crazy old neighborhood.
You know, you have, I would say that the East Bottoms vibe is very closely tied to the identity of your business.
Yeah, us and Frank and Knuckleheads, he, you know, he planted the flag and, you know, he pulls in a different clientele, a different time of day, but the two of us have been the face for a long time. And of course, we're all looking forward to what Andy's going to do at the Rieger. I think it's going to be amazing for the neighborhood. But, you know, we first started thinking it was going to be a wholesale place, and the actual neighborhood was just kind of interesting to me, and that's more or less why we ended up. I loved the building. I loved the neighborhood, just because we could not literally do whatever you want, but at the same time, you know, it kind of is like a little bit like the Wild West.
So can you describe what the neighborhood was like when you got there and what appealed to you about setting up shop there from the outset?
Sure. I moved here about 11 years ago, too, and I moved to the River Market, and I was a restaurant chef, and I used to go down to get fish from, there was two fish vendors down there, so I would drive by the building we're in for years and just thought it was the coolest old building. And
Describe what was made it the coolest old building in your eyes.
You know, it first off, it just is this big, heavy brick building with these huge iron columns out front, and you could just tell it's been there forever, and it's got this ghost writing Ed J. Saloon on the outside of it, and you knew it had history, and you knew, I just could feel it was something special and that it used to be something really interesting. And, you know, it was just a big open box, and the people that redeveloped it did a great job leaving a lot of the bones in place, and it had a big parking lot which helps. And it's 5 minutes from downtown, which helps. So it was a pretty easy decision.
Your presence has, like you said, kind of created a mirror destination for knuckleheads. Knuckleheads is this place that if people had been to the neighborhood, they went there at night to go to knuckleheads, people who don't have any other reason to just be there in their day-to-day existence. And now you had given them a reason to stop by during the day. Do you think that your leaving will change things?
I hope not. I know Andy is planning on doing a lot of daytime activities, a lot of consumer-facing business.
Andy Rieger, excuse me, Jay Rieger Distillery.
With the distillery. The Electric Park, the Hospitality Center, everything they're going to do is going to continue what we've done.
What do you know about their plans?
You know, I know more or less what's in the press release. I know they've been discussing for a long time about making something that can host the public and show them the amazing stuff they make. They, you know, the whole crew there is, you know, obviously they come over for lunch all the time. They're great people. They do great products. I'm a little torn that we're leaving when they're opening, but, you know, it's the way it worked out, and it is what it is. But they're going to continue pulling in a lot of people, and really it's going to continue to be a destination place because of what they're doing.
Have you seen kind of like a local food production hub growing up around you there?
A little bit. You know, Yoli Tortilla, which makes handcrafted corn tortillas. They are just across the street in one of the Nigros buildings, and we purchase their tortillas. They come every other, you know, couple of days and drop off fresh tortillas. So that's been cool. Casey Canning is just down the road as well in the old hamburger joint. So we've seen a little bit. You know, rent's cheap. Space is available. That's good for, you know, new coming food producers. Those are two things you need.
How do you hear all the predictions about gentrification and the neighborhood, you know, the writing being on the wall as far as if it's been the land that time forgot, it seems like time is remembering?
Well, on one hand, you know, we're not going to make any more real estate, and it is very close to downtown and very close to River Market, and it's easy to see people heading that way. On the other hand, Cargill's not going anywhere and General Mills isn't going anywhere. And there is not, basically there's not a single empty building in there. It's not the Crossroads. It's not the West Bottoms. There's nothing to fill in, you know? So I'm sure folks will come, but you know, if nobody puts their house up for sale, then they can't just take it.
We did get a call from someone who wasn't able to stay on the line, but she's someone who lives in the neighborhood and just wanted to make it known that the neighbors aren't interested in gentrification.
I don't imagine they are. I don't imagine they are, and they shouldn't be. They've got a great neighborhood. They've got a great little, you know, we've enjoyed being part of the neighborhood, and they've been nothing but extremely hospitable, pleasant, and really nice to, you know, we've never had a single crime problem. People think the East Bottoms is going to be dangerous, but we used to have a shop in Westport, and I feel 100% more comfortable in the East Bottoms than I ever did in Westport.
Can you explain that?
Sure. It's not that there aren't people around, but everybody down there is doing their business, doing their thing. There's a lot of business people down there. There's a lot of manufacturing. There's a lot of people making things. There's a lot of great, great, great humans that are down there all the time, and everybody looks out for each other. And you know, we have plenty of valuable things that sit outside. Don't come steal my stuff. But never in 6-7 years have we had a single thing go missing. If we have something that we don't need anymore and a scrapper wants to come by, they'll walk up the back door and say, hey, are you done with this? We'll say yes. They'll take it away. And, you know, it's just been very respectful, which is, you know, the best word I can use for the whole place. You know, it doesn't look like the suburbs, that's for sure. But that doesn't mean it's not a nice place to be.
Michael Bushnell, chime in here. Is this is the East Bottoms you know as well?
That's exactly the East Bottoms I know. And excuse me, I certainly understand that worry about gentrification. There are some development plans, infrastructure, municipal infrastructure plans that are on the books right now. One of them is to build an overpass where the Gardner Railroad crossing is over to Front Street. We actually had a lady that lives very close by call our office and say, oh my God, they're going to take my house. So we made some phone calls, and we're not going to take your house anytime soon because there's no money for this project. And I can certainly understand the worry about gentrification, because if the ball starts rolling, then all of a sudden those property values start to come up, and we end up with another West Side on our hands, where people get priced out of their houses where the family has lived for 80 years. And I would certainly hope that that is not the case.
When you say there are a lot of plans on the books, can you give us any more information than that?
Just in regards to some of the, like I said, the railroad crossing for the, I called it the Gardner overpass, that would free up a lot of traffic on Gardner and Front Street, that there's only that one crossing right there. That's one plan. One of the other larger businesses in the East Bottoms has been very quietly acquiring property. Cargill has been acquiring a lot of the vacant lots down there for whatever reason, but don't know if they're going to be expanding that operation. There was talk of shuttering it at one point in time, but they seem to be ramping up. But basically just infrastructure. The water department is down there, and so, I mean, that's good too. But that's the only project that I know of right off the top of my head.
It's interesting that the interest in the East Bottoms is sort of peaking at this time that really coincides with this revival of Kansas City's old brewing and distilling traditions.
I think it's been on people's radar for quite a long time. I really do. And when you look at the history of the Heim buildings, and that's where the first electric park was located before it moved out to 47th and Paseo in 1907, there's been a lot of interest in those buildings for the past 10 years. And when John McDonald sold the brewery and started acquiring property
Boulevard Brewery,
I'm sorry, thank you very much. He started acquiring property up and down Gwinnett Avenue, and that's really when things started to gel. And our newspaper, the Northeast News, wanted to do a couple of stories on that, and he said, no, let's just hold on to that for a second. And so we've just been kind of waiting, and obviously now the green flag has been dropped, so we're out of the gate.
Right. This has all been brewing quietly, though, behind the scenes for some time.
It has.
Jacqueline, jump in here.
Oh. Well, it is pretty interesting. You know, this is like a large industrial area, and the folks that do live down there, it does seem like a lot of them did work and do work in manufacturing, and that's all why they live down there. So they live and work right next to the businesses that keep them sustained. And so it's interesting to see these things change. And I think people don't often talk about, like, there's like a large vibe down there that, like, with Frank at Knuckleheads, like, bringing in, like, the motorcycle shop. Like, there's a huge motorcyclist community, especially with Headlights. Like, getting to see, like, that bar and grill really take off after it was Hobos and, like, the Red River Tavern. And so it's exciting to kind of see just, like...
It's like a little dive bar or neighborhood bar.
Yeah,
or...
like, these kind of saloons. Like, it's cool to just see these places not be, like, Westport or the Crossroads. Like, they're appealing to people who maybe are a little, like, I like... a little excitement that's like maybe a little off on the edge.
It's kind of interesting that when what people are drawn to is a place being unique, that what ends up happening, though, is that the process turns it into one of, like, being more like other places.
Yeah, that's sort of just what happens in the end. You start to develop, and then things kind of get bought up, and, you know, people, too many folks know about it, and then it just kind of becomes like the next Westport. But you've got these golden periods, so you should enjoy it now.
Let's talk to a caller, Rashawn in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Rashawn.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Good. What can you share?
Well, I used to own the home that Ferdinand Heim built at 350 Boulevard. It's a lovely Queen Anne-style mansion with... complete with witch's cap and all of that good stuff, and looks like a little turret toward the top there. So just thought I'd share that bit of trivia.
And so, wait, this used to be one of the Heim brothers' homes?
Actually, Ferdinand Heim, who was the sort of the head of the family, owned that home right on the corner of 300 Benton, directly across the street from the Concourse Park there. And then the three homes to the south of his on Benton Boulevard belonged to his sons.
Well, so Michael Bushnell, I can see you kind of calculating and following the directions with your hands. You're plotting out the map of the city. Okay, first of all, tell us what you know about this, but also, what interests me is that connection between the Northeast on the whole and the East Bottoms, because you're the editor of the Northeast News, but this is sort of part and parcel of the territory that you feel part of.
It is, and there are still four original Heim houses on Benton Boulevard. 300 Benton Boulevard was actually incredibly close to the wrecking ball in the early to mid-1990s. And in the late 90s, somebody came in, thankfully, and bought it and started the restoration process. 318 Benton Boulevard is the rectory for St. Anthony's Parish. And 320 and 324 are the two twin houses. And if you look at 320 and 324 Benton Boulevard from Google Earth, there's a circle drive that's actually shaped like a heart in between the two houses, and they share a massive carriage house to the back of the house. And that's where the Heims lived up until literally the day that the last one died. In the 1940s. So, and obviously they had the brewery down below, and one of the Heims, I think, was he had the first motor car in the city, or he was the first, I'm crossing my wires on that, but definitely pioneers in Northeast Kansas City history along Benton Boulevard.
We have someone on Twitter asking us about the building that that J. Rieger and Company has just bought, that they've just announced that they've bought. We talked about how long that building sat abandoned. And she's wondering, how do you have a building in the middle of the city just sitting there abandoned for that long? Why was it not torn down or sold before this? It must have been well made to not have fallen down.
It is. It's a fortress. It is a veritable fortress. And buildings like that, the walls are 12 to 18 inch thick with 3 and 4 casts of brick before you get out to the outer layer of finished brick. And the building was built in late 1890s when the brewery started to be built, and the rail line was built from downtown to feed the park. But the East Bottoms kind of fell out of favor in the 1940s, and it just started this slow decay to where in the late 80s, early 90s, it was more or less all industrial, and you just drove through it because you were on your way to here or there, or it, like we used to do, still do. It's an easy way to get from City Market to St. John and Belmont with two stoplights. And
you know, Alex Pope, do you think that the East Bottoms is going to be the next West Side or Crossroads or neighborhood like that? Because it seems to me that if you thought that, you would be staying. It would be worth that investment.
Honestly, no. The Crossroads has, or had, you know, 15 years ago, it had plenty of empty buildings that were well-made, that were ready to be inhabited again. And there isn't empty buildings there. It's chock full of people. You know, you just try, do a car count when you go down there. There's tons of people down there. They're not consumer facing businesses. They're not restaurants. They're not bookstores. They're not things you find. They're not boutiques, like you would see in the Crossroads. They're business to business businesses that are, you know, they're servicing other businesses. They need access to the railroad, to the semi trucks to get on the interstate. And, you know, if you're going to have, you know, gentrification in the sense we've talked about on West Side, Crossroads, West Bottoms, you need empty buildings for artists and people to come into. And they're not there.
Well, so what are you going to miss the most about the East Bottoms as you head to the City Market?
Oh, a lot of things. You know, sometimes the City Market is going to be amazing for hustle and bustle, which I love. You know, I love being in the city center. But, you know, the quiet, the peace and quiet is great until the train comes. You know, just having the space without having a lot of eyes on you. We've enjoyed everything, though. It's been a great neighborhood.
Well, this is not our last conversation about the East Bottoms. We will pick this up another time. Alex Pope, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And Jacqueline Danger, Michael Bushnell, thank you both, too.
Thank you very much.
I'm Gina Kaufman. We will hear from our friends at StoryCorps in just a minute on KCUR's Central Standard, so don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And about a month ago, we welcomed StoryCorps to Kansas City. They've had the mobile recording station set up in front of the Block building for several weeks. Kansas Cityans of all stripes have been recording intimate conversations that'll be preserved for the ages in the Library of Congress.
My name is Dini Good. I'm 38 years old.
My name is Corbin. I am 10.
I'm Jim Brett, 99 years of age.
Hi, I'm Nisha Gamby.
And I'm Joel Barrett.
I'm 65, new.
I'm age 52.
I'm Sarah Morris. I'm 53 years old.
Erica King, 33 years old.
My name is Sergio D'Acosta.
And I am Ophelia G. Acosta.
I am 37 years old.
My age is 65.
My name is David Seymour.
David Clark.
I am the middle child, David Wolf. I'm 46 years old.
I'm Dawn Wolf. I'm age 42.
Dawn was the baby. Spoiled.
Today is August 8th, 2018.
Today is the 20th.
Today is August 15th.
Oh, August 10th, 2018.
In Kansas City, Missouri.
I am in Kansas City, Missouri.
We are currently in Kansas City, Missouri.
And I'm talking to my son.
So, what happened during those conversations? We hear the beginning and it's so enticing. But were there any big revelations about our city or, dare I say, humanity? Let's find out with Jacqueline Van Meter, who's been bearing witness to all of those conversations. Jacqueline, hello.
Hi, Gina. How are you?
Good. What are your overall impressions of Kansas City, having sat in on all these conversations that we're going to dive into just momentarily?
Kansas City's been a really interesting place to record and to interact with the community. The thing that has stood out most to me is there's just such a pride in being from here and being part of this community. That has been a huge theme in so many of the conversations. People love to talk about the history of the city, the way that it's changed, the sort of dividing lines that have defined certain neighborhoods and the way that those are shifting. All of that has stood out. And people just feel a real sense of pride and connectedness to this place.
Before you got here, we talked about the project in general, and you said part of what you were hoping to hear were conversations that go across political divides. From the little bit that I've heard, it seems like Kansas City delivered. Let's hear a snippet of one of those conversations.
You obviously are a staunch Republican, and I am a staunch independent.
I am a staunch conservative. We've talked about this. I break from the party. I mean, I am very socially liberal. You know me. I'm like, hey, legalization of marijuana, I'm good with that. Gay marriage, love is love, I'm fine with that. Don't touch my money, though. That's mine. And I believe in a strong military. So, you know, if you want to put me in a box, I always say I'm a conservative.
If you want to put me in a box. Jacqueline, tell me about that conversation.
So this was actually facilitated by one of our staff members, Melissa Velasquez. And, you know, we get all different kinds of pairings, and people come for a lot of different reasons, but we kind of keep a running list of things that jump out to us that might be interesting to include in these sort of panoramas that we edit together. And she immediately said, I have a brother-sister duo, and they came to the table and decided to talk politics. You have to include it.
There's a lot of laughter in that conversation, and it's such, I can't even tell you what a relief it is to hear people who disagree about politics laughing about it.
Hear, hear. I know. And I think it's interesting that people use the sort of StoryCorps forum for that kind of conversation, because I think that there's this understanding, this mutual understanding that, okay, we're gonna sit down, we're really going to listen to each other, we're going to give each other space to have these conversations. You know, if this is happening at the Thanksgiving table with a glass of wine, things might get a little different. But there's a respect that people bring and a willingness to sort of check their emotions and listen and keep a sense of humor about it that happens in the booth, which I think can facilitate these conversations in a positive way.
It is a conversation by appointment, and I think that can be different too. You don't catch someone off guard, you know.
Exactly. Both people are they're coming into it with intentionality, deliberately, and they're going to really give each other the focus that they deserve.
Kansas City's relationship with race, I would say, is very particular. And as an outsider listening in on conversations happening in this very space cocoon, you know, a very safe cocoon-like space. I wonder if that's something that came through.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, we also had some really interesting partnerships with different community organizations to make sure that we did get different perspectives on this. And, you know, certain folks have lived here for a decade and other people have been here all their lives. And certainly there is a complex history of race and division and segregation in this community. But it seems like people were all very willing to sort of acknowledge that and to recognize the thorniness of the past and that some of that continues on today. But
it's a big relief to hear that, yeah. Because kind of the refrain here is that Kansas City doesn't want to talk about it.
Right. Well, I think that, again, in these spaces, you know, people feel a little bit safer and they're willing to be a little bit more honest and to recognize things that they might not ordinarily take the time to recognize.
So I have a clip that I'm hoping you can put into context a little bit. This is a woman talking about being a child and moving from one Kansas City neighborhood to another.
Yeah, I lived on a farm. We had chickens and hogs, a big garden.
Were you rich?
No, I didn't have any money. I don't think I had two pennies to scratch together.
Okay, that was not the clip that I was meaning to play. I'm sorry about that. We'll just skip ahead to that one. We'll get back to the race conversation, I hope. But this is a guy, I mean, I'd love to know his story. His voice just jumped out to me. It reaches to you across the speakers. Like, tell me about this guy.
So that's Jim Pratt, who came in with his son-in-law. And he was actually a World War II veteran who his family was very inclined to bring him in, 99 years old, to remember a bit about his experience being deployed largely in the South Pacific. But he started by talking about his sort of humble beginnings in Alabama and has only come to Kansas City kind of recently as his children have settled here. And he just had such a personality, and his family was so excited to get him in just shy of his 100th birthday.
So he is really, like, this seems like he's telling a very personal story. He goes on to talk about how, you know, he at lunch at school, he didn't have what the other kids had, what that felt like. But this is, in addition to being such an intimate story, it is also about class in this region.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And you know, I think what I appreciate about what he brought into the room is he was very candid and very honest about these things, but he also had a real sense of humor about it. I mean, I think at 99 years, you've seen so much that he was willing to sort of share these details, but also to keep perspective on it and to recognize, you know, where his family is now and the sort of transition that they've made over the years.
So let's get back to the conversation we were having about race. We have this clip ready that, yes, just to remind people, this is a woman talking about her childhood, moving from one Kansas City neighborhood to another, and what race had to do with that experience for her.
We used to live at 4000 Benton. The neighborhood I lived in was all black. Mm-hmm. It was the north end of Kansas City, Missouri. Being a child who grew up in segregated places around people who looked just like me, there was no question. There was no conscious awareness of me not being okay. And my mom moved us to 55th and Garfield. It was me and my mom's best friend who lived next door. And we were the only black people on the street. I started middle school at that time. And my first day and first year on the bus, I had things thrown at me. I had bricks thrown at the bus at me. That's when I had this brutal, I would call it brutal to this day, awakening about what I am is not okay. And I had nightmares. It was rough. It's just, you know, it's like that's nothing to be happy about. And I didn't understand, but it made me hard.
What, Jacqueline Van Meter, this is your first time in Kansas City, and you're hearing conversations like this.
That's right. Yeah, this was one that was facilitated again by a staff member, Melissa Velasquez, and it immediately stood out to her as just offering these really specific, concrete moments about the history of this place, as experienced by, you know, a woman when she was a child. And it's, I think a lot of a number of conversations took place where people sort of tried to make sense of their experience in this town over the years. There's another conversation that you may have heard, and you know, in which people reflect on how they grew up in different neighborhoods and the similarities and the differences. And people here were really willing to just kind of deconstruct their experiences here and what implications that has for being from Kansas City and how that shaped people's identities. It was really fascinating.
People could talk about anything, and it is surprising to me that Kansas City is such a big part of what they wanted to talk about. Not, you know, not something more universal, but just really about a lot of people wanting to talk about being from here and being from specific neighborhoods and specific periods of time here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and it's interesting and challenging and fascinating for us as, you know, admittedly outsiders to come into this community, and we're trying as quickly as possible to sort of piece together what does it mean? When people talk about this neighborhood, what are they saying? What is this implicit understanding that people have if they're from here? And those lines and those kinds of identities seem to be a very pronounced part of being from Kansas City, and people really wanted to talk about that.
So politics, class, race, neighborhood divisions, all of those things come out in these very personal conversations. But then you also get stuff like this.
Do you still wish you had siblings?
No, because now I found out that they're just a ton of work.
I love that laughter. What is happening in this conversation?
I love these two. So this was Deanie and Corbin. They were really precious. I facilitated this one. And they, Deanie homeschools Corbin, and they decided to come in, I think, on a Wednesday and take a big long weekend to go to the Iowa State Fair. And they wanted to kick off their weekend together by coming in to record at StoryCorps. And, you know, it's a lot of times when people bring in they're young kids. And Corbin is 10 years old. They're expecting to sort of interview the kid. And in this case, Corbin really wanted to interview his mom. So he had all these sort of serious questions for mom. And then she would kind of turn it around on him. And you could just see there was so much affection. They were so, so close. He's an only child, as you can tell. And he just thinks of his mom as his absolute best friend. When they introduce each other, as all participants do at the beginning of the recording, they have to state the relationship to who they're talking about. And Corbin said, "I am talking to my mom, who is also my very, very best friend." Aww. So you could just, the affection there was palpable. I had to find a way to include them.
And how did Corbin learn that siblings are a lot of work?
Isn't that an interesting question? He went on to talk about how he has friends that have siblings, and I think at first he was a little envious being an only child, but then he realized you've got to share the computer, and they'll take stuff that's yours, and they'll tell their friends that it's theirs, and that's not fair. So he's definitely in that stage right now where his stuff is his stuff, and he don't want to give it up.
Is there a conversation that we haven't talked about that's going to stay with you as you continue traveling the country and as you move on to other jobs? Because this is a one-year post, like a Kansas City conversation that is just going to be part of your, how your brain understands the world.
Oh, man. There have been a lot. It's been, honestly, Jane, it's been a really emotional week. You know, there have been some really, really touching conversations. Just yesterday, actually, a woman came in to interview her mother, who had been one of the first women to study engineering in her undergraduate class, and the challenges of being the only female engineer in a very male dominated industry back in the 60s, and just the respect, the humility, the love, the admiration between the two of them. You could see just how much of a role model this woman was to her daughter, who's now in her late 30s. And similarly, the pride that she had in her daughter, who has made her own way professionally. They were just tearful and honest, and it, you know, especially in the wake of all of this discussion of the Me Too movement, to hear the way that this woman navigated this heavily male-dominated industry and how much admiration her daughter had for her. You know, when they've been having this conversation their whole lives, but something about being in that booth gave them the opportunity to really honor each other in that way, and that one really moved me.
So where are you off to next?
We're going to Charleston, West Virginia in another week.
Mountain Mama.
That's the plan. Take me home.
Jacqueline Van Meter is the site manager for the StoryCorps mobile tour across America, and she's getting ready to leave Kansas City after about a month. Jacqueline, thanks for everything and good luck.
Thank you.
You can listen back to anything from today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. We talked about the East Bottoms, and just recently we've been talking about the conversations people have been having with each other here in Kansas City as part of the StoryCorps project. Catch what you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, the artist who's been working with tires dragged out of the Blue River in Swope Park. One man's trash, right? Tomorrow at 10. Let us know what's on your mind, what you think we should be talking about on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. And that's a wrap for today's show. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, with help from Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.